Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 94 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So yes, welcome again to another special episode of the Outlander podcast. These are becoming more frequent.
It seems we just spoke with you guys, or, you know, shared something just the other day.
Well, this week, we were delighted to have the opportunity to speak with a director from the series. He directed a block of Outlander. His two episodes were The Devil's Mark and Lallybroch, and he goes by the name of Mr. Mike Barker.
Film and television director Mike Barker's career has spanned nearly three decades. Besides Outlander, he has worked on television series such as Broadchurch and Silent Witness, and the films A Good Woman and Butterfly on a Wheel, to name a few. We'd like to give a huge Outlander podcast welcome to director Mike Barker. Good morning, or good afternoon.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
How are you? We're doing well. How are you?
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for asking me on.
Anytime. Absolutely. This is a thrill.
And are you enjoying the show? You enjoying the series, the TV series?
Oh, let me tell you. Yes.
It's really funny because we don't get it here at all. It's not broadcast here at all.
Yes, we know. It's only on the Amazon Instant Video UK, and that's not everyone has that. So it's always difficult when the average person just can't turn on their telly and see it, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't even know what Amazon television is.
It's part of Amazon Prime, I think, or...
Oh, I do know what it is. Of course I do, yeah.
So, before we get into more specific questions on Outlander, we had a few, because of your experience and your long career, we had a few questions about your very unique point of view. So, preparing for working with filming for movies or filming for serial television, what's the biggest difference, and do you have a preference? What has your experience been?
Well, series television is quite unusual because there's lots of directors and there's lots of writers and then showrunner at the top and then sort of the writers below, directors, and everyone's sort of working in small teams and rotating. So there tends to be a really big sort of production machine sort of rolling alongside and you just step on and step off a bit like a bus. So it's quite fun to do that. I think probably more satisfying is doing drama from beginning to end, whether it be for TV or film, because you start with the writer, you work with the writer, and you cast it, and you work all the way through. So I think probably there's much more responsibility in sort of single drama, and I would suggest, I think, probably that I prefer that. Although getting on and off that bus sometimes is great fun.
We can see by your ID, IMDb, profile that you've been in the business for quite some time. Have you seen any significant changes in the television and film industry since you began?
It's really funny hearing you talk about 3 decades of film career because I'm pretending obviously that it's only my second year and I'm still really young and sort of full of it. But I think that actually it has changed quite a lot. It's become much tougher. It's become much leaner. And it's become much more result-based. I mean, there's much less, and probably to its detriment, there's probably much more sort of less experimenting with filmmaking, because actually people work on very, very tight schedules now. I mean, the schedules are so tight. I'm shooting The Tunnel at the moment, The Sky, and I think we shoot 25 days, and you know, that's 2 hours of finished film. I think America is even tougher sometimes. I think I did a show in America, and I had 8 days to do an hour of TV. And the problem with that is, of course, you can do it, but it's very much about getting the job done. And some of that creative excitement that I certainly had all the time when I first started is now a bit more about practicalities. But having said that as well, the other thing that's happened is that the quality of writing for television has got so much better and it's become a medium in its own right. Whereas it used to be when I first started, it was very much the sort of the poor cousin to doing films. And now, actually, I literally have no preference. I mean, I love doing a film, I do films, and I love the fact that, you know, they're going to the cinema, it's on a big screen. But actually, the way people view things now, the quality and the way that which we view them at home is so different to how it was 20 years ago, that actually, I love doing TV now.
So had you read the books before you decided to jump onto the Outlander bandwagon, or was that something that you did after you became involved?
They sent me the first script, and they sent me the pilot that hadn't been finished, but was being put together. Because I think the pilot was quite long in the making. I think they'd spent a long time sort of working out what they were going to do and how they're going to do it and the tone. And, you know, they really used that pilot as a template to sort of spring forward into the next, you know, into the rest of the series. So I saw that, and then they sent me the book, and I read the first book before I turned up in Scotland. And if I'm really honest with you, I hadn't heard of the books before. I didn't know them at all. I know you're all big hardcore fans, but I didn't know them at all. But I really loved it. I really enjoyed it. It was really, really fun. I thought there were some great worlds. I loved the combining of the worlds. I thought it was a really clever way of sort of combining, you know, that period and time travel. It's two really fascinating periods. And both of which I've filmed separately, actually. I've done different projects in similar periods, but never intertwining them like that.
So you mentioned they sent you the script. So that, did they pursue you for this project, or was this something that you kind of heard about and pursued yourself?
No, I didn't know. No, like I said, I didn't know anything about it. They came to me. In fact, they came to me quite early on and asked me to do something, but I was busy doing another show and I wasn't available for the first scripts they sent me. And when I became available, the producer who runs the show up in Scotland for Ron Moore, he called me again and asked me if I could reconsider and come back again. And of course, I was more than happy to. And in fact, I had a fantastic time doing it as well. Glasgow's a fantastic city to hang out in, and it's a really fantastic city to hang out in, actually, especially when you're on your own and there's no children, they're all left back at home. So it was great. It was great. It was really great. And so I moved up there. It's quite a short stint as well. I mean, they're quite short stints. I think it's 6 weeks prep and 4 or 5 week shooting. So it's very intense. And I had some pretty big set pieces in the episodes I had as well.
So did you know how wildly popular these books were? Were you aware of the very large and passionate fan base, or was that something you're only experiencing after the fact?
No, well, I sort of, you know, obviously, once I'd sort of signed up, you know, and I started to read the books, I did a bit of homework and started to check it out and find out, you know, what a bit more about it. And I was quite surprised by how many people did know about it. And then, you know, on the internet, the great joy of the internet now is it's such a great tool to find and learn things that it didn't take me very long to realize how much excitement was bubbling in America, especially about the forthcoming show. So it was actually quite exciting to get part of. And then, of course, when you get to Scotland, it's a huge production. I mean, it's big. It's really, really big. They've taken over a huge, big computer factory over there, which had closed down a few years earlier. And they've converted it into 3 or 4 more stages and, you know, built huge, big sets in there. So when you get there, you suddenly realize that you're part of something quite big.
Summer mentioned the fan base. When you actually were in, maybe not so much pre-production, but when you were there on the set with the actors, with the extras, in both or either episodes, did it kind of become a little bit more real in your mind as far as, you know, oh my goodness, there are so many fans out there. Did you feel any pressure to actually, to quote unquote, do right by them? Or did they influence you at all as you went into doing your best work here?
I think, you know, I mean, every meeting we have, you know, so basically, you know, I'd sit with Meryl and Ron and Tony, who wrote, who was the writer across the two episodes that I was working with. We sit down all the time. So you're sitting down all the time and, you know, I'm making a case to do, you know, to do something, or, you know, to change something, or to clarify something. Because what's quite good about not knowing the books brilliantly, in the way that the writers know everything so in so much detail, if I didn't understand something, it probably meant that it wasn't clear enough for people who aren't big fans of the book. And it became, every conversation we had was defined by the fan base and popular moments and really important, you know, like, for example, the wedding, which I wasn't part of mine. You know, I remember sort of the conversations leading up to the wedding were very, you know, were very, very sort of involved and mindful of the fans and not to change things. I mean, Ron's not frightened. I mean, Ron's the man who's in charge of all that stuff. That's, you know, that doesn't really come down to the director to make those decisions. I mean, I ask the questions, but someone like Ron, he's quite good because what he does is he knows what's important, but he also knows what doesn't translate well to the, because it's a completely different medium. And because we're such a visual medium, there's things that we can do without having to read or without having to say, and because when, especially when you've got good actresses and actors, often they don't need to say anything. So sometimes, you know, we'd come in, you know, we'd have two or three pages of dialogue, and actually there'd be a really simple little moment. There'd be a really simple little moment where, you know, and you just think, well, actually we don't need this dialogue anymore, you know, and it just fall away. But all of those moments were very much defined by expectation, people's expectation. And occasionally, you know, Ron would, you know, say that what we need to make, I know that there'd be huge arguments, you know, with Tony and Ron saying, Tony saying this is really important to the fans, and Ron saying it is. And, you know, we have to pay homage to that moment, but we have to do it in a different way. So, yes, it was a huge factor, I think.
In preparing for the episodes, did you discuss a certain plan of attack, if you will, with Ron, Tony, Meryl, and others involved?
Basically, what happens is literally the day that you arrive, it's quite frightening, the day you arrive in Scotland, you've still got your suitcase, you have not even been to the hotel. You're sort of ushered into a little room where you meet Meryl, Ron, Tony, and basically we sort of have a tonal conversation, a conversation about the tone. When I arrived, my scripts actually hadn't been finished, they hadn't finished writing them, they were still very much being written. And then of course what happens is you encounter things. So for example, that lovely beautiful old mill that I filmed, we found that mill, and so, you know, the guys took that mill and then sort of wrote that mill specifically into the script. So it's constantly evolving. Everything's constantly evolving from the moment you arrive pretty much to the moment you leave.
Given the two episodes you worked on The Devil's Mark and Lallybroch. Which would you say was more of a challenge, filming the chaos of the courtroom or the thinly veiled placidity of Lallybroch?
Well, I think actually the Lallybroch one was definitely more difficult for me because it, you know, in terms of drama and getting your teeth into something, there was much less of it. It was a much more of a linear journey, and it was, you know, and ultimately it was a very simple episode in terms of staging. But what's very difficult about those types of episodes is actually sort of pacing and plotting and, you know, and making sure that, because the actors were asked to do quite a lot. There were very few scenes, but they were very, very long and involved sort of very long performances. What's interesting for a director with that kind of thing is actually how you stage them and how you bring actors together and how you introduce them into a scene, how you separate them from a scene. And actually, you know, how they behave with each other in a scene, and also just, you know, how to sort of make sort of those long dialogue scenes play and maintain the interest. The Devil Mark was, you know, honestly was much more exciting for me to do because, you know, I obviously had the trial, and I had, you know, when I turned up, you also, the other thing is, you must remember as a director, you're always asking for things, right? So you're normally just people saying, no, we can't afford that. On the Devil's Mark, we literally, you know, I can't tell you, when I first went to that small church, that small Presbyterian church up in the Highlands, and I saw for the first time what I'd actually asked for and what it was involved, you know, when 250 people turn up for 5 days, It looked like a music festival. There was tents and there was metal roadway. There was, you know, 15 caterers. There was coffee shops. It was, you know, you walk on and you think, oh my God, they've done everything I asked. I can't believe it. And that was also one of the great things about doing the show, was that I think that if the producers felt that, you know, it was going the right way and it was going to work, they really pulled the stops out. And I really felt that. You know, I really felt that on my time up there. I felt that they really sort of, you know, they had faith. They trusted. We trusted in each other. And as a consequence of that, there was none of that defense. So everything, you know, everything was just delivered. It was fantastic.
So fair warning, I got to say this: in the book, which I'm a huge fan of all of the whole series. So I'll say that. But in book one, Outlander, my favorite sequence, more than the stones, more than the end, more than their meeting, more than the wedding, is the witch trial sequence. And I have said this almost since our very first podcast. And I think our listeners, I've said it so much that I'm getting tired of it now. But just so you know, this is coming from not just a super fan, but a super fan who's obsessed with witch trials and this sequence in particular. So I was probably more than any other episode looking forward to The Devil's Mark. And thank you so much. Knocked it out of the park. You and Tony Graffia, of course, the whole production team. It was an honor to watch. And when Summer and I recorded our podcast discussion after the episode, it's the first time, hopefully the only time, because it's a little embarrassing, it was the first time I actually started to cry.
Oh, God.
Oh, my God. Do you know, I had my heart in my mouth because I wasn't quite sure where it was going.
Oh, my gosh. No. But it's all good. So all that to say, yeah, you not only have fans here, you have probably one of the biggest fans of this sequence. And so that pairing, the synchronicity of how this came together is just, I mean, heartbreakingly, superbly wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
No, you're more than welcome.
No,
more than
thank
welcome.
You.
Thank you. So I just want to give you, that's the kind of the background where these questions are coming from. So what were some unique challenges or surprises about filming in the Thieves' Hole?
The Thieves' Hole was, the most difficult thing was that, in fact, I got into quite a lot of trouble over, was that I had quite a lot of rats brought in. But no one had actually mentioned to the poor actresses that we had rats. So the very first shot, I think I almost lost both my actresses. I think I almost lost my job. Because they brought the rats in, and so they were sort of acting. The poor girls were acting away, and then suddenly they could hear this sort of fiddling around by the corn by their feet, and suddenly they looked down and they screamed for real. And I'd also made them the rats all muddy as well, so they looked particularly rancid. But the thing about shooting in there, what was difficult about shooting there was it's actually a very small space. I mean, it looks quite grand, actually, but it was quite small. So the moment we threw those girls in there and they bounced off that wall and down, the production, what we did with those rocks, we actually had them built out of a special foam. So when we threw the girls down and they hit the side and they rolled down, it's actually made out of foam. And it meant that I could actually throw them a bit harder than you would normally. So the first two girls that come down are stunties, and then it's the actresses for the second phase.
Oh my goodness, love this information. This is amazing. So in Ron's podcast about episode 111, he did a podcast with Tony Graffia. And
right.
They mentioned that, or she mentioned, because in writing the script, it was very important to her to show Claire and Galus's relationship. She was very drawn by this very unique relationship. Two women out of time, there for different reasons, one with an absolute purpose, one by accident. What was important to you as a director? What was important to bring across to the viewer?
The thing is with Tony and I, Tony, I mean, I didn't know Tony before we got out to Scotland. We both sort of landed up there, sort of strangers in the same town. And in a funny way, that was the best thing that happened because this doesn't always happen that the writer and director have a great relationship. Often it can be quite sort of frictional. But actually, both of us got on really, really well right from the off, and we were sort of fairly like-minded. And so our conversations—I mean, the conversation in terms of directing versus writing—is essentially the same. I mean, the point of a scene is the same. You know, I mean, I come at it slightly differently, of course, because I've got to visualize it, and I would probably tend to sort of be. To allow the physicality of two actresses together as another tool, whereas a writer tends to sort of lean more on dialogue to get the same point across. But because we spent so much time together in Glasgow, sort of hanging out and discussing the discuss, because we only had one thing in common at the time, which was the show. And so we were pretty in sync in terms of the point of a scene and the what it was meant to deliver to the audience, what the fans were expecting of it, and also how we could sort of enhance it and make it feel real, and so I think all of these things where you involve jeopardy like that, what's important from a director's point of view is to make it feel real, and because you're in such a sort of unusual land and you're talking about a time that people really don't know, you know, in terms of the history of it. And things like that cave, I mean, that cave was built on a stage. The bottom part is built on a stage. It's all built out of fiberglass. I guess it, the real thing about it is making it feel like it really is dangerous, that actually they really are in a hole and they really are facing death. And what, that framework for the conversation, for me, is really important. So it's not just the conversation. It's actually the framework of the conversation. It's like what's before it and after it. What's the implications of, you know, of the sun coming up in the morning? You know, are they going to be, you know, are they going to be burnt? And I think, you know, and I think that sort of, I think what it did in that hole was it sort of allowed us to force an honesty out of the two girls in a way that we probably wouldn't have been able to do had there not been the threat of death hanging over them. So that was something that was particularly difficult. And then the other thing was just making sure those caves glistened and felt real. So we had water running down them. We had mist. Those poor girls were down there and they were soaking and damp. And I tell you, Scotland is so bloody cold. You will never imagine. It's unbelievable and damp. And so those poor girls were literally in there for 2 or 3 days, damp and cold, whilst doing all that performing. Well, and covered in rats.
And what's so interesting about that is that this is one of the first scenes in this entire series where you've taken away all the beauty of Scotland and you've put that your actors in a space where there's basically almost no other distraction for the audience, and they this whole scene had to be played on them. They had nothing else to fall back on.
Yeah, and it was quite a challenge as well, because I think, you know, I think at one point, I'm not sure if this, I think we cut quite a bit out in the end, but I think when I went in there, I think I had about 15 or 16 pages of dialogue down there, if I remember rightly. And that, you know, and it's such a small space that to keep, you know, staging and making things interesting and picking up the details of, you know, the hands and the, you know, and the pregnancy and all of those different things became really important just in terms of breaking up the monotony of two people just talking to each other, you know, so you're constantly provoking the audience into listening. So it's not just, so it doesn't become a radio play.
In the thieves' hole, Gailis first tries, the first night, I believe, Gailis tries to get Claire to touch her baby bump, but Claire wants no part of it. And the second day, when they're about to leave the thieves' hole for the last time, Claire willingly puts her hands on Gailis's stomach, but there's a very short beat, and Gailis pretty quickly takes Claire's hands into her own and brings them up to her mouth, and she kisses her hands or puts them next to her face.
Yeah.
What I read this as Gailis, because they were being observed, they were just about to climb out. Gailis didn't want any observers to notice anything that might bring attention to her belly and maybe get a hint that she's pregnant because she's holding on to that for her own purposes. Was this the intent?
I mean, that intent was definitely discussed, but actually I think equally it was about the two of them coming together and understanding each other in a way that they hadn't possibly understood each other before because Gillis' character is pretty conniving, and once she was discovered, I think that it's quite difficult for Claire. So I think that whole night of talking and sort of coming together and realizing that she really was in love with Gillis really was in love. I think it was also, we played that angle as well, that actually it was a coming together and these two girls were going to face death together. And this was the last moment they had privately before that moment.
So in Ron's podcast, Tony talked about how dedicated the extras were in the courtroom scenes. Were there any challenges to working with that many extras?
And the passionate extras.
Do you know what I do? And the thing is, I mean, I don't know how unusual I am in this, but I do. What I do is I always go to speak to the extras first. I never will have an extra come onto the set and just start. So what I did on the morning, on the very first morning, I went by myself down to the tent, the holding tent, where there was, you know, all these people all dressed up in their costumes. And I basically just told them the story. I told them what the story was and what they're going to be doing for the next 5 days. And in fact, I remember Ron's wife, who does the costume, she said, you know, we've got a disaster because these guys won't stay for 5 days. They will never stay. We'll be, you know, we'll have 250 and by the end there'll be 80. And because that's often what happens. And do you know what? We lost two people across the 5 days, and we only lost them, I think, because of a car crash and they couldn't get to work on time. So, you know, so basically it's really important, I think, is you go and tell them, because they're performers And if you just treat them as if their background is like a prop, that's exactly what you'll get. You'll get a prop. So if you go and talk to them, you explain what the story is, and then we gave each guy's numbers. And so because often if I give a direction to 250 people, they will all do the same thing, because that's the direction you talk. So if you talk to them en masse, you get the same reaction 250 times. So what I do is I break them down into smaller groups of 10 or 15 or 20, and then I give them very specific directions about how I want them to react to certain things in the trial. I then separate those 20 people so they're in different places in the room. And then I'll take another 20 people and explain how I want them to react to different moments so that everyone's not doing the same thing at the same time. And then I'll distribute them out across the room. So the idea is that people are actually, they have their own performance to give. And I think they really did. The Scottish extras were absolutely impeccable. And, you know, I was really grateful to them because ultimately, you know, it's a nice room and, you know, there's a couple of great actors, but without that atmosphere, there would have been nothing. And that's all down to those extras.
So did you direct any of the extras to want Claire and Galus to survive that? Or were they all directed to basically want them
no,
to burn?
No. There was, we had women in there who were basically, you know, who were sort of, who could feel the weight of the law and the weight of the court going against them. The truth of it is, when we actually did a bit of homework, you know, actually, people wanted to, they couldn't wait for a witch burning. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a highlight of, you know, of the time. And people really, it was like sport. We're really, really, really sort of, you know, it was, you know, people baited these girls and sort of people lied just to get them, you know, to get them into a burning. I mean, it was pretty bleak.
My theory on that is that they were very cold and they wanted a large community fire.
And they had no TV.
And they had no TV, that's for sure. And they
that's what Summer said in our podcast. They were very cold, so they needed the warmth of the fire, and they had no TV, so they needed the hysteria as entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's probably something to do with it.
Ron also mentioned in his podcast that, or maybe Tony it was, that the courtroom scenes were predominantly shot straight through. Was this your decision or a mutual production decision?
It was my decision, and the reason was because even though 250 people a day sounds like quite a lot, because actually you think about it, 250 over 5 days is suddenly 1,500 extras. So it became, you know, it's a big number, but we were also rotating, I was moving them around. So this is the other thing I had to be very careful about, is that if you're really clever and really careful, you can actually spot the same extras in different places. Mm. And that's because I rotated them. And so we do little costume changes and maybe a couple of wigs here and there. And actually change them. But the reason I did it all the way through was I really wanted to, and in fact, it's not strictly true. I didn't shoot it all the way through. The various different scenes I broke down, but within the scenes, I did every shot went from the beginning of the scene to the end of the scene, but not the sequence. I couldn't have managed the whole sequence because I had people in different places and doing different things. But it was really to try and keep that atmosphere going because there was quite a bit of suspicion about putting Galus above everyone's head and carrying her out of the room the way they did. Not everybody was convinced I was doing the right thing when we did that. And so, but I was quite adamant to do it. And so it just allowed everyone to see that the whole scene was working as a whole. And it just sort of, you know, it just meant for me I didn't have quite as much pressure or concern about how that was staged, if I'm honest. That was one reason.
So once you rile up all your extras, is it difficult to get the control back in that scene? Like, is it hard to like get the energy back down if you needed to give new directions?
I think what's difficult about it, and this is a difficult thing for the sound team, is what I was doing is I was allowing the extras to speak. So the poor actors are acting and doing their lines whilst the extras are speaking for real. So it's very, very noisy. And so the actors are really shouting in order to, you know, they're really working hard to get their voices heard. Traditionally, what you would do is you'd get all the extras miming and they'd all be pretending. They'd sort of be physically doing the same thing, but actually physically not saying anything so the actors can speak. But to me, it didn't feel, it did with 250 people, it, you know, you're asking actors or extras who aren't actors to actually be, you know, quite a complicated thing, which is to perform silently. And I've never found it particularly convincing. And, you know, with modern technology nowadays, it's actually quite simple and clean to actually solve the problems you create by having so much noise at any one go. But it really helps that atmosphere. And so, yeah, so it was quite hard for the actors. I mean, they had to work really, really hard in there. What is tricky is that little moments, like for example, when they both the girls realise about the, you know, the, they have that little quiet moment on the podium where suddenly everything slides away and it goes very quiet. Things like that's quite difficult when you've got 250 people screaming, kill her, burn her. we sort of carve little windows out for those sort of things.
Well, I thought that having that really added to the performances to Katrina and Lotta's performance, because they sounded like they were fighting for their, well, yeah, especially Claire, because she was the only one talking during the courtroom scene. She wouldn't shut up. But you could tell, it just sounded like she was literally screaming for her life.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite exhausting environment to work in because it's very small. It's a bit like being on an aeroplane. You couldn't move because once you had the little aisle down the middle, but as soon as everyone stood up to move, it was a complete logjam. So we had to be, the whole thing was a really difficult, it was very hot. We also had a bit of a disaster as well. Part of the church got broken, the floor broke, and we had to evacuate because they found some sort of strange thing that they thought might have been asbestos. So in the middle of it, in the middle of that sequence, we actually had to stop for 8 hours while all the health experts came in and pulled the church apart and made sure it was safe for us all to return. So it was quite a tricky little sequence to shoot, but it was great fun. It was great fun because everybody was there to do it and do it justice. You know, there was no slackers on any front. It was great.
Besides the emotional impact, of course, we heard Ron and Tony say that during the filming that some of the female, well, I guess anyone, but specifically a number of female extras were actually, honestly, crying in reaction to Claire being flogged. Was that a surprise to you? Was there any, a certain way or a sensitivity that you approached maybe that specific part of the sequence with?
Well, the thing about the violence and the whipping was that it really was quite shocking. I mean, it really was quite shocking. I mean, I remember thinking it was quite shocking. And we shot it incredibly simply. You know, we originally sort of were thinking about sort of doing it really sort of in a complicated way where we were going to put the scars on her back and then digitally remove them and sort of reveal them as they came back. But actually, Katrina was so sort of effective. I don't know if you noticed how I shot that, but I actually shot it very simply. I mean, it's really, really simply shot. It couldn't be more basic. And it was, and the reason it worked like that was because Katrina was so solid. And, you know, I really felt, you really did feel when she was hit. In fact, the first time she was hit, I thought something awful had gone wrong. And, you know, I sort of moved forward thinking she'd been hit by accident. Because it's all done by distances and trying to work things out and stunt guys, making sure that everything's safe and she's not really getting hit. But she reacted so brilliantly on the first one that I literally, my heart fell on the floor. I thought I just hit the leading actress. I mean, she was really convincing. I mean, it was really, both the girls, you know, on that day, on those few days were amazing. They really were. It was a really, really tough few days for them. Because those schedules are tough for those actors because they, you know, they come thick and fast. The pages come thick and fast.
When Jamie and Claire are kind of, you know, either getting ready to go or they've just left, and Galus is being taken out mosh pit style on her
crowd surfing
on her back, you know, taken out, and she's done the scream and shown her devil's mark. One of the last things we hear from someone that's audible and that you can make out as the end of this scene is the judge saying, like almost in a protest, "She's with child." Was there a reason, an extra reason, that line needed to be highlighted? Because people who have read the book or the books know what happens later on, but, you know, without giving spoilers, the viewer doesn't necessarily know.
Well, I mean, without giving spoilers, it's very specifically there, and it's there, okay, for a very specific reason. It was quite intentional.
We don't want to go without mentioning probably the most important scene in the book, which is the scene at the stones, or the whole sequence of Claire making her decision both to tell Jamie and then, of course, to stay with Jamie. What specifically was important to you in filming these scenes?
Well, I think the most important thing is the decision, what is the decision? And, you know, it was quite funny, that scene, because it was actually, you know, she's on her own, and I was looking for visual references on how to get across to the audience, you know, that she was sitting there with a decision. You know, she spent her entire time wanting to get to the stones, to step back through them so she could get back. she could get back to her former life. And, you know, and now she's fallen in love with a guy. And so basically, one thing that I noticed when we were filming is that she had the two wedding rings on. And those two wedding rings were a perfect metaphor for me. You know, they were really simple, simple sequence. In fact, that scene that you saw is not all shot at the location you think it is. It's actually shot. So all of those close-ups on the rings were done. I'm trying to remember the name of the location. But do you remember after she was whipped and she got taken away and she went to the horse by the river with the horse?
Oh, yes.
Where she basically confesses that she's from a different time. All of those shots with the rings on those rocks were actually shot there. We shot them all at the same time. And I sort of cut them across because when I saw those rings, I thought, oh my God, that is it. That's the key. And so I shot those. And so that really helped me with the decision making. And then obviously I wanted to, you know, for the audience, I wanted to create a sense that has she, hasn't she? I mean, I wanted, you know, everybody to think that she had gone back. And so that's basically, you know, to save that moment for when she comes back to the river and comes, you know, when we discover that she hasn't actually left at all. I wanted to protect that moment as well. So that was really what it was about. It's about decision. And it's also about making sure that, and again, she did a fantastic job of that, Katrina. She was so good. And, you know, it wasn't that difficult. It's so beautiful up there. And the stones are so powerful. I mean, it's quite interesting because they're obviously made out of polystyrene. And so you're sort of standing there, sort of surrounded by polystyrene, but they've got a real weight about them. There's a real sort of, they're really beautifully done.
Now, that was such a brilliant scene by the river when Claire was basically coming clean to Jamie and telling him everything, like the range of emotions on like Sam Heughan's face while she's telling him, and then his realization that he beat her for trying to go back to her people. And it was just such a brilliantly shot scene, I thought.
That scene was probably the single most difficult thing that we tackled on the whole show, that one scene. It was hard for everybody. It was, you know, it was a really, really tricky thing because there's so much rested on it. It's one of those scenes where, you know, you could get it so badly wrong, so, you know, so easily. And, you know, and Katrina, I remember poor Katrina, she worked so hard and, she was literally... she was complete mush by the end of it. She was absolutely exhausted. I made her do it so many times to get it exactly as you saw it. But I think it was worth it. I think, you know, I think we all thought it was worth it at the end.
I think it was worth it.
It was all worth it.
But it was really, really tough, especially for Katrina. I mean, she really was beaten up that day. It was a really, really tough day. You know, and you're so exposed. You've got such a big message to get across. You know, there's 100 people standing there in a wood looking at two people. And, you know, and so she knew that she had the weight of the entire series and all of the fans and everybody else are on her shoulders on that particular moment, because it was actually one of the, you know, it probably is sort of, you know, probably the most difficult moment in the whole, in the whole concept of the whole book, I think, probably, you know, becoming honest about who you are.
Absolutely. It is between her confession and her choice that are kind of the cornerstone of almost for the entire story. Without this, the other books couldn't even happen.
Yeah, no, exactly. And so, you know, and it's really difficult because, you know, you sort of have 4 hours or something. You know, so you know you've got 4 hours to get all this stuff that you can. And it's such a responsibility because, you know, we spent an hour just talking about it and rehearsing it and sort of working out how it's going to go. And then suddenly it's 3 hours, and you know this really big moment's still not been addressed. You know, and you start doing it, and it's not quite right. And then you start, you know, you just keep chipping away. And then you see something that you think, okay, that's the avenue into this sequence. That's how we're going to do it, Katrina. That's the way in. And then, you know, and then you sort of, you know, and then she finds something else, and then she starts to find more comfortable. And so slowly work your way through and actually discover it.
Ron said in his podcast with Tony Graffia that the BJR full frontal scene was unscripted. And how unscripted was this, and whose idea was that?
Well, I tell you how it all started. It all started in a wine bar in Glasgow. And it started off as an argument between Tony Graffia and myself about women nudity, and why is it that all women have to, you know, bare their breasts in almost every scene, whereas men never get their cocks out? That was basically the gist of the conversation. And So I was charged with asking him to take his, to actually do that. So that was the funny thing about it. So it became a big conversation. You know, I had no problem. He's a very good actor. I just went up to him and asked him, said, listen, we're going to do this for real. Are you up for it? And he's like, I'm up for it. And he did. And it was as simple as that. But it sort of, so it wasn't scripted. It sort of came out of a conversation of, you know, why we expect Katrina to bear all the time when, in fact, the blokes never have to do it at all, except when it just comes to their shirts off, you know, when they're toying in the fields, getting suntanned, covered in sweat and being, you know, so it was really Tony was the one who sort of had that idea, I would suggest.
Have you been asked back for season 2? And would you return if asked?
If you haven't been asked, would you?
I would. Well, in fact, funny enough, I spoke to David. Unfortunately, I'm shooting the tunnel now, so I can't. They're starting in the next 2 weeks. In fact, some of my crew have just left me to go and start on it. But I'm not here. I can't go. I'm going to be in Spain until the end of August. So I'm not available. And then after that, I've got to go to Cuba. So unfortunately, I can't get involved, I don't think. But of course, if they ask me back and the dates changed, of course I would go in a heartbeat. It was such great. It was great fun, and it's great crew. And Scotland's a beautiful place to hang out.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Mr. Barker, so much for joining us here on the Outlander podcast. We respect your time, and we understand you have a job to go do and bring us more wonderful entertainment.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate you.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay, bye. You too. Bye-bye.
It was such a huge honor to get to speak with Mr. Barker, and he was just so... You could tell that he loved the time he spent on Outlander, and he was so disappointed to not get to go back for season 2, but maybe season 3.
If something happens, then...
Seasons 3 through 8. I know Ron doesn't want to commit to it right now, but I think that Mr. Barker should.
Well, thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.